you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the television series Twin Peaks. We are from No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. We are not a spoiler-free podcast. We would love to have you listen, but if you haven't seen the show, don't listen until you watch the entire series. You have been warned.
If you like this podcast and you want to support us, you can write a review on iTunes. You can also go to our website at noship.net and click on our contact page and write us some feedback. Also, you can use our Amazon link that gives us a kickback from whatever you purchase. It doesn't actually increase your costs. Amazon actually gives us a very tiny percent of what you spend, and maybe one day we'll save enough money to pay for our bandwidth. It's a dream.
Yeah, we can dream.
Yes, but hey, that's what Twin Peaks is all about. So help us dream.
I like that. That's a good tagline. Help us dream.
And before we get into recap, do you have a PSA?
For the remainder of the podcast, please stay on the bike.
Okay, this episode we are discussing Twin Peaks, Season 2, Episode 6, Demons. This was written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels, and this is directed by Leslie Linka Glatter. Any thoughts on this episode before we get started?
I expected more of an episode called Demons. Now, honestly, this is another solid episode, and I'm, you know, watching these Season 2 episodes, and Season 2 is so universally derided as being, you know, where it went off the rails or jumped the shark or whatever other TV-related cliche you want to use about how the show just wasn't good anymore. But I'm surprised at, you know, how much when I'm watching it, I still feel like it's Twin Peaks to me. You know, I'm still waiting for this other shoe to drop. And I know there's some parts where it does get kind of bad, but I guess we're just not there yet. I was expecting it to come a little bit early, but I still feel like it was solid.
The episode opens with Orchids, a self-maimed Harold, and some dissonant music. Maddie and Donna crouch together in front of him. He berates Donna for being like all the others, and he calls Donna unclean, saying she has contaminated him. When he lunges toward them to take the diary, Maddie screams, and in bursts James to the rescue. He pulls Maddie out, yelling for Donna to follow. Donna is unable to keep the diary in her grasp after Harold gets a hold of it. They run outside, and James checks in with Donna to make sure she is unhurt. Maddie looks on with some jealousy. James has suggested that they go to the sheriff, and Donna says she will go in his stead.
Yeah, he's already in too much trouble with the sheriff anyway. Harry doesn't want to see him in there. Cooper doesn't want to see him in there. He could actually be in some real trouble if he gets entangled up in anything else like this. But yeah, Maddie's a little bit jealous because he's making sure that Donna's unhurt. But I mean, she was the one who got grabbed right away whenever he came in the door. Like, he busted into the door and made a beeline for her. So I guess that's the only, you know, I mean.
It's like they're all flip-flopping about their feelings for each other.
He's just like, hey, by the way, grab the diary and get your ass out here, if you can. If not, just get mauled by his trowler or whatever it was.
Yeah, because she's looking on with jealousy about, you know, when she had talked to Donna, she was telling Donna, there's nothing between us, but clearly.
Clearly there was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we saw her making the googly eyes at him whenever they were having the horrible song moment. And then there was the other moment after that Donna walked in on him when they were kissing and stuff. It's kind of been spray painted on the wall, so it's a little bit silly for her to just be like, it's like those scenes from those old movies where the man and the woman are in, you know, entwined in an impassionate embrace, and then she pulls away and she's like, no. You know, it's obviously it's yes, or you wouldn't be here. So I don't know.
Back at Harold's, in a rage, he hydrates his orchids. He begins to yell, and his yell sounds like the denizens of the lodge.
Yeah, it has that echoey effect on it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if echoey is the correct term, but it has some sort of effect that's put on it, and it does sound like them. Mm-hmm. So that's what he was doing. He was hydrating them like he's killing them, because too much moisture is a bad thing, right?
Didn't he say that?
Yeah, he said, well, the moisture is not enough, and they die too much, and they get all kinds of diseases and everything. So it looked like he was doing it in this fit of pique, you know? He was just like angrily doing it.
I don't know if it's going to kill them.
That, I guess I'm just putting that out there because we know what happens to him. So I don't know. No one's going to be there to take care of his orchids for him. So I'm just wondering if it's his
form of mass suicide.
I guess he's giving them the Kool-Aid to drink.
Cooper carries an unconscious Audrey into the bookhouse. Hawk and Harry are with him, of course. Cooper lays her on a bed and checks her vitals. He notices track marks. Audrey begins to talk in her sleep, saying, Daddy, can you see me? Can you catch me? She then begins to feel like she is suffocating. Cooper calms her down and she awakens. She tells Cooper that she prayed for him to come and he did, and he hugs her.
That's a sweet moment between them, but it's a sad moment for her because, I mean, she's still pining away for the attention of her dad, and she's still not getting it, you know, because she wakes up and Cooper's there, and that's a good thing. But at the same time, you know, her daddy's still nowhere to be seen except at One-Eyed Jack's.
It's weird though for she, can you see me? I understand, but can you catch me?
I don't know if that's like a little kid thing, like, I'm
Yeah.
gonna fall, can you catch me? Or I'm not sure. Or is it metaphorical because she was falling into this black hole and nobody was there to catch her?
I was just thinking how sad it would be if, like, you see Audrey as a little girl and she's trying to play this game with her dad and he's ignoring her.
Yeah. You know that a lot of that went on because he's so work-minded, and then so, you know, whatever else he's doing with on the criminal side of things, he's so focused on that. He probably wasn't the best dad in the world.
So now we're back with James and Donna. They see Maddie off. Donna is feeling some chagrin for her recent actions, and James says it's just you and I.
Oh, now it's just you and I. Finally, you're coming around.
And the music's playing in the background.
You can just always know that James is going to say something corny whenever you hear the guitar strings playing that tune. It's going to happen.
But he actually says the just you and I was the chorus of that song, and he actually says that to her.
See, that makes it worse.
Yeah. So now at the sheriff's department, Harry looks at mugshots. Cooper talks of how close Audrey was to death. Harry finds Jean's picture in the mugshot book. Harry tells him about the tape that featured Cooper at the blackjack table. Cooper laments his going out of jurisdiction and how it has brought trouble to Audrey. He tells Harry that this is not the first time this has happened, and Harry tells him he is the best lawman he has ever seen, but he thinks too much.
This was a good scene because I think Harry's given Cooper the respect that he's due, because I don't know if they've had that conversation before, and he's letting him know. He's like, look, you're a better lawman than anybody we got here and the best one I've ever seen. And that's including himself, which, as we've commented on before, Harry is probably not the best lawman, maybe even in Twin Peaks before Cooper showed up. But it was a nice touch to their friendship, but he's right. You know, he's delivering that with a sense of humility. He's saying, look, you're the best at what you do as far as I've seen, but you think too much, man. You just got to let it go. You did a good thing, and instead of, you know, taking time out from it, maybe patting yourself on the back, you're listing all of your flaws and all of the things you did wrong, which is also a commentary on Cooper's character because he's just so strict and by the book that even when he's done something great, he can only look at the downside of it and be like, I could have been better. He's so self-critiquing.
This is where they're slowly starting to feed us the background about this Wyndham Earl character here
Yeah.
and Cooper's past with him.
It's also a setup for the future too, because if I'm not mistaken, a lot of the stuff that happened kind of contributes to why he isn't part of the FBI anymore later on in the
Yes.
series.
So now at the Great Northern, Coop meets with Ben Horn. He gives him the briefcase and he also tells Ben where Audrey's now being held and that Blackie was partially responsible. He tells Ben that Blackie was murdered by Jean Renault and that Jean Renault has escaped. He also tells Ben that Audrey is recovering from a drug overdose. And you see this sink in.
This is the only thing that surprised him because he asked a bunch of questions and they were really suspicious. Like, oh, did you catch him? Did you kill him? Did you do this? You know, he asked it about Blackie. He asked it about, you know, Jean Renault. But then when he says that your daughter was on an overdose of drugs, he was like, what? What the hell? And then, you know, the how much danger she was actually in,
And I
kind
think
of.
he also understood why, because
Yeah.
Blackie was, it's vengeance.
She's taking it out on the wrong family member, but it was the only one available.
And then Ben thanks him for bringing his Audrey back to him. And I'm sure he meant to say his
His
briefcase.
briefcase, yeah. Because he's opening that thing. Before he asks where his daughter is, I think, unless I'm wrong, I think he asks this before he asks where Audrey actually is. He says, he opens the briefcase to make sure that the contents are safe.
So now Leo's homecoming is ongoing. As Shelley has been fearing, it is not turning out to be the free ticket Bobby was imagining. They thought they were going to get $5,000 a month, and after all the fees and whatnot, it amounts to $700. The man implied quickly extracts himself from the situation. Shelley's like, next time, call me, tell me what you're wearing, so we don't clash. But he's trying to extract himself from the situation. I think At least it looked like that to me at first, but not so much this time around because it seemed like he was trying to hurry out of there, like he's had this reaction to this check before.
Right. Well, everybody thinks they have a free ticket, and then when all the deductions are taken out because everything has to be paid for, because the insurance isn't just money to you, it covers all of the things that, go along with convalescing or taking care of somebody. People don't think about that stuff, especially not a 12th grader like Bobby Briggs.
Yeah, and so this guy leaves, and Shelley asks Bobby, what are they supposed to do? And then Leo makes a noise and startles them. So this is also in true like soap opera fashion, they start to plant the idea that Leo could come back around. So Donna now tries to tell an obstinate and maybe annoyed Harry about Harold and Laura's secret diary. Gordon Cole arrives, and he's speaking very loudly because he is partially deaf. Gordon Cole is there to check up on Cooper after he has been shot. He brings Albert's recent lab findings, and these are as follows. A hair that belonged to the shooter came from a vicuna coat.
What is a vicuna coat?
I believe that's a type of animal.
Oh, okay. All right.
Let me just double check. The vicuna is one of the two wild South American camelids which live in high alpine areas of the Andes. They produce fine wool. I believe this is a very expensive.
Sounds like it.
As of June 2007, prices for vicuna fabrics can range from US dollars, $1,800 to 3,000 per yard.
Jeez. So whoever the shooter was had some money.
A men's top coat can cost up to $30,000. Woo! Yes, so there's vicuna for you folks. Okay. So he also says at this point that the medicine in Philip Gerard's syringe was of some unheard of combo. They get more information on that later, I think.
I believe so, but they mentioned haloperidol, right?
Not at this point.
Oh, they don't? Okay.
The papers found down the road from the train tracks are from a diary. And then right on cue, Hawk drags in the one armor, as Gordon Cole calls him. Philip Gerard is protesting his arrest, asking what is wrong with selling shoes. And then after everybody has dispersed or actually gone to Harry's office, Donna, since she was left inside the interrogating room, she looks out like, what the hell?
Yeah, what the hell is going on? Because, like you said, they were talking very loudly, so she could hear everything they were
Yeah.
talking about. So her head's probably spinning. She just had this run-in with Harold and the secret diary, and now she's hearing about, the shooter of Cooper and the one-armed man and all this other stuff. It's like, what the hell? No cigarettes in this episode, though, from her. So that's good.
So next we have Ben. He's visiting Audrey at the bookhouse. Ben says thank God and that he was worried about her. She, of course, does not believe him and tells him she is aware of a lot of things now and that she saw so much. He is hip to the uptake and tells her they will sort it out when they get home. Audrey wants Cooper to take her home, and then Ben suggests that they all ride home together.
She's not happy with that, but she doesn't countermand it or anything. Now, do you think that he's aware of her being the new girl?
No,
No?
but I
Okay.
think he's aware of what she could know.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. She knows something, that's obvious. I guess you're just saying the extent of which is not determined at this time, but it's enough to give him pause and be like, all right, we'll talk about this later when it's just you and I.
Now, Nadine comes home from shopping. She asks when her parents are coming home and maybe they should pretend that they are married. She punches him in the gut and talks of necking. I really truncated that scene just because I'm not really all that into it, so.
Yeah, full disclosure, the Ed and Nadine when she's a teenager scenes are not my favorite. There's I strongly feel like this was a way to add a little bit of oddball humor to the show, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I also felt like Ed and Nadine were the people who actually play them, Everett McGill and Wendy Roby, were like director and writer favorites. They really like them, and they may have even been under a contract to be for so many episodes, I don't know. But they were kept around, and their stories kind of become a little bit stronger later on, at least Ed's does whenever he starts to get more entangled again with Norma. But for now, it's just kind of these little soap opery, kind of funny offshoots, and I'm not gonna sit here and deride them, for 5 minutes, but I'll just leave it at that. They're not my favorite parts.
So this could be an aftermath of a rape. I'm not really quite sure. We actually have some feedback on this, so we'll discuss about it or discuss it then. But this is a scene between Josie and Jonathan. He gives her plane tickets back to Hong Kong. She's not ready to go because she has not received that insurance money.
She's got a couple of financial entanglements that she hasn't resolved.
Her deal with Ben,
Yeah.
another. So Jonathan says that Eckhart needs her and he will make it worth her while, even though she will miss out on these deals. He is very hands-on and it's very annoying. The blocking of them two together just annoyed me.
Well, there was a duplicate in the scene that was unnecessary because he reaches his arm around and it's like he's saying, I basically without saying it, he's saying, I could choke you right now.
Yeah.
And he does that twice. So one time would have been okay, but the second time I felt like, are they really paying attention to the blocking here? Did somebody really go over this with a fine-tooth comb and make sure that this was right or necessary? Because I think we could have gotten the same, as the viewer, we could have gotten the same message out of that scene without that happening twice.
Right. It's excessive. Harry's brought up in this conversation, and it is evident that she cares for Harry, despite what we think, because we've had that discussion.
She cares for Harry. I recognize that. I just don't think she cares enough for Harry for my taste because I really like Harry. I think he's a good guy and I think he deserves better, but we've known that from the beginning. You could tell.
So now Maddie sits by the lake, and James pulls up on his bike. He sits with her and apologizes for having feelings for her, basically. She acknowledges that he saw Laura in her and that she kind of liked it. She tells him that he and Donna belong together, and despite this, he gets morose about it. She tells him she is leaving tomorrow and they say goodbye.
The look on her face, though, when he's talking about having the light shining on him and everything, and actually being in love with Donna and recognizing that he has these deep feelings for her, she has a look of sorrow on her face. And you're supposed to be looking at him, but they're both in frame, and you can kind of see it. And this was a decent scene because it kind of gave you closure to their relationship, and what's going to happen next.
Yeah, that's on rewatch. That's what actually has more adds more weight to the scene for me, is because this really is goodbye.
Yeah, it dominates it, and it's
Yeah.
the lighting and the area that they're at and everything else is completely different from anything else we've seen in Twin Peaks because everything else seems to be filmed either indoors at night or on an overcast, cold,
Yeah.
cloudy day. But here we have a day that could ostensibly just be spring for all we know. I mean,
Could
it
be
could,
LA.
yeah, it could be,
It
it
is
could be, oh,
LA.
it is LA?
Yeah.
Well, no
That was
wonder.
supposed to be a joke.
So they're burning up in those coats, because they're dressed rather warmly. But do you see what I'm saying, though? Like the sunniness of it and everything. I think it was
Yeah.
meant to be like a feel-good scene, and it was very different from the color palette of the rest of it. But now that you know what's going on, it takes a pretty ominous overtone. Come to Twin Peaks for Laura's funeral, stay for your own.
Speaking of change in tone, Josie, after we just left her, in the previous scene, she's got a completely different behavior when she's meeting with Ben in his office. Josie wants her money before she gives him the contract with Pete's signature. He makes some promises and she tells him she will not leave his office without her money. He tells her about a dossier he has on her, and she has her own backup plan in a form of a safety deposit box. Stalemate. He gives her the check from Tajimura and she gives him the contract.
Do you think either one of them were bluffing as in regards to the amount of information that they really had on the other person?
It's possible they were.
I mean, I think that there's enough to do damage because they're partners in crime, literally, literally. So, yeah, there's definitely enough information in their heads. Forget about a safety deposit box, visited upon death, but what they could just run and tell the police right now, but it would incriminate, I guess that's the whole point of it. It's one of those fail-safe things, kind of like, well, if I die, I can't go to jail anymore, so you're going down. But I just wondered, it felt like it was a little cat and mouse game of bluffing, to see who could chase who the hardest. But he has a begrudging respect for her, even though he gave her a check that he doesn't really know the validity of, I guess you would say.
He calls her mine Quicksilver. I
Yeah.
beg to differ.
Yeah.
No offense to.
Well, I think that was, I think he was just trying to play up to it and just be like, you're smart enough to know to kind of, I think that puts people off sometimes. When you have an unexpected compliment from somebody, it throws you off your game if you're in there to do a certain thing.
Yeah. So you think he was manipulating her in
I
that way?
do. I think he was manipulating her in that way. And I think he did a masterful manipulation by giving her the check for 5 million, because as she's walking out, he's lighting up yet another cigar, and he's like, "And Josie, well played." And actually, he's playing her, because that check could be just as worthless as the paper it's printed on.
They're both being played by Catherine.
Yeah, true. So I guess it's a moot
Actually,
point.
back at the Johnsons' household, Shelley and Bobby are now celebrating Leo's homecoming. They list all his crimes he has committed against Shelley and then begin to make out on the table in front of him. Shelley looks up at him and it appears that Leo lowers his gaze to look upon her. She gets freaked out, which freaks Bobby out, and he is now apologetic towards Leo. He does not want to exploit him or anything.
All of these,
Too late.
this coming home cake and party hats and balloons and streamers and all of this kind of, crap that they, it looks like somebody's having, it looks like a 5-year-old's birthday party.
I think it's a metaphor for teenagers having a baby in a way.
I didn't think of it like that. But I do know what they spent their $700 on now.
Yeah, what a
That and a bottle of Jack.
idiots. Bobby also tells Leo that he and Shelley are going to do everything in their power to make sure he is safe. I'm sure Leo's comforted if he can hear any of that.
Yeah.
So now Cooper arrives at the sheriff's department and is happily reunited with Gordon Cole.
This is a great scene when he just walks in, he doesn't even look, and he snaps his finger and points.
David Lynch is so adorable. Moving on, Cole says something cryptic. He says, "Coop, you remind me today of a small Mexican chihuahua," which prompts Cooper to ask Harry if they can use his office. Gordon Cole tells him that Albert thinks that Cooper is in over his head, and he brings up Pittsburgh, where Cooper ended up in the chute. Cooper tells him that yes, he has been wounded on the job, but that is the only similarity it has to Pittsburgh. Cooper then asks about the Mexican chihuahua, and Harry barges in to tell them that they can hear everything outside. They invite him in anyway. Gordon passes an envelope that came addressed to Cooper by a familiar handwriting. It has what they call a chess deal. It would be called actually a chess move, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And the chess move is P to K4, an opening move from Wyndham Earl. Gordon says they are going to have to watch Coop's back from now on. It took Harry a while to barge in and say, "We can hear you." I don't know if something about the Mexican Chihuahua. Okay, that's enough. We don't need to hear about
Yeah.
that.
Maybe this is some sort of weird code between them, and
I'm finding this less and less interesting.
I thought you guys were going to talk about some, really cool crime shit, but you're just talking about chihuahuas. So you're done.
Can you quiet it down?
Yeah.
So, yeah, they call that chess move a chess deal.
I've never heard that before. That's
Yeah.
Twin Peaks is the only time it's an isolated incident in which they call it a chess deal. And they call it that twice in
Twice.
this episode. And I
Yeah.
can't recall if they call it a chess deal again in any other
We'll
episode.
find out.
Well, yeah, but it's I play chess a lot, and it's a chess move, plain and simple. But it's a correspondence game that's being set up, and we don't know what the stakes are yet.
In which we're going to have a chessboard in front of us for this podcast, and Steve's going to make those moves so we can watch how it plays out. Apparently, it's a pretty crap game.
Really?
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and play it out.
I mean, pawn to king four is a pretty standard opening. I mean, 99 times out of 100, when you play somebody, if they're white, they're going to start with that move. So I guess it just gets wild if you're right, if your sources are correct. The game gets kind of wild and crazy because either the people writing it don't really know how to play chess all that well, or they think that no one's paying attention to it. But we'll see.
We'll see. So Leland and Ben enter Ben's office. Ben is saying that he needs Leland back with Jerry on the road. He claims to understand what Leland has gone through since his own ordeal with Audrey has just taken place, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, one guy's daughter was found dead, wrapped in plastic in the water. The other guy's daughter is safe and sound. She almost suffered a drug overdose, but I mean,
He wasn't concerned while she was gone, so.
yeah. But one thing, there is a similarity here, though. In both instances, the father was the primary cause for the daughter's condition.
True. Very
So
true. Good point.
there's that. So maybe, there is a little bit of validity to what he's saying, just not in the way he intended it.
So back with what they're discussing, because Ben wants to bring Leland back into the fold, but first he needs to know Leland is truly okay. It's been too many incidents with Leland. So Leland says, yes, I'm okay. I'll prove it to you. So Ben starts to run down their current predicament with the Ghostwood Estates. Leland starts to detail how they would stall the Icelanders with some various things with escrow and the Cayman Islands and
Legalese.
yeah. And meanwhile he steals some fur
Off of the stuffed animal.
from a white fox. Ben sees this, but he continues on. And after all is said and done, they give each other an awkward hug.
Very awkward man hug, you know, when men try to hug each other and they just don't know what to do. They should just go for the big bear hug and embrace, you know, because men
Yes.
always pat each other's back, so it's not seen as something else, I guess.
Yeah, you gotta make a lot of vocal noises like rawr,
Yeah, that's just part of it.
just show how manly you are. So it's nobody.
No,
It's like no homo, no
no
homo.
hands going down the small of the back, that kind of thing. It's softly caressing. It's just not part of a man hug.
Harry arrives at Josie's just in time to catch her before she leaves with her assistant, Mr. Lee.
Big air quotes. How the hell are you going to be dating somebody for months and then tell them, oh, you haven't met my assistant, Mr. Lee? It's like, I'm pretty sure I would have known you had an assistant by now.
She tells him she is leaving, that she sold the mill, that it is over, and she is going home. He tries to convince her to stay. She tells him she is sorry and not to think badly of her. He tries to prevent her some more. She tells him it is best he forgets her. He tells her he loves her twice, and she walks away anyway.
Good riddance, really.
Now he's good at showing anguish, though.
Yeah. I just felt so bad for him because Mr. Lee comes back in and he's like, Mr. Lee, leave us alone. You know, everybody's been in that position at some point. You're trying to have a heart to heart with somebody and then somebody else just kind of inconsiderately comes back in the room when they know what's going on. So it was kind of cool just vicariously to see him be like, hey, just get out of here. Just go away.
Ben and Tajamura talk after dinner. I wonder if it was hard for Catherine to eat through that costume. Tajamura wants to know why, after having given Ben a $5 million check, why does he have nothing in return? Ben talks about the mill fire and how it has created unforeseen problems. And then Leland starts to sing in the background, and Ben tries to stop him hilariously.
Yeah, he doesn't stop him at all. He fails and he gets
Pulled
kind of
in.
roped into the show a little bit. But he has some good commentary about how if any of these people are on your jury and you're claiming temporary insanity, you're going to get off scot-free.
Meanwhile, Pete talks to Tajamura about musicals. It's a very cute scene between Tajamura and Pete, and I think we're supposed to suspect that it was Catherine. I think they want it. I think the reason why they have this scene is that the creators were expecting us to know all along it was Catherine.
I don't remember if the first time that I saw that I knew it was Catherine. Do you?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I mean,
I really don't.
if I did
I'm
know,
sure, I guess.
it wasn't right away at any rate. So you think that this scene and the little interplay with, you know, Pete is supposed to let you know that this is her, or give
Yeah.
you the clue, like more of a clue if you haven't been paying attention.
Yeah, sometimes you know more information than the people on the screen. I think
Yeah.
this was one of those things.
Okay.
But
It's
without
still
them explicitly telling us,
a... Okay,
we were
okay.
supposed to figure it out.
I just like at the end of it, he's like, would you like a glass of cold milk?
Yeah.
That's what he's drinking.
Yeah, 'cause he drank milk at another event at the Great Northern when she poured her champagne on his on Ben's shoe.
Oh, yeah.
I think Pete was drinking milk then too. Okay, so back to the final or now to the final scene of the episode. Back at the sheriff's department, Cooper, Gordon Hawk, and Harry question Philip Gerard. Philip Gerard is begging for his medicine. They do not give it to him. And Philip then transforms to Mike, which Mike is an inhabiting spirit. Bob was Mike's familiar. Where they come from cannot be revealed. He also says that Bob kills for fun. When he wears a smile, everybody run. He talks about how he and Bob used to be partners, and now his purpose is to stop him. Bob has been near for 40-something years, and right now he is at the Great Northern Hotel.
Yeah, he kind of ends it with a little riddle, you know, that talking about how there's rooms, so many rooms that are all the same, but different souls inhabit them, you know, every night.
Probably because it's the only way he knew how to communicate it. He probably
Yeah.
doesn't know the word hotel.
Blaine the Pain would have seen right through that one. I'm just putting that out there right now. Now, did you notice in this scene that when they're asking him these questions and he says, Bob was my familiar, and he said, where did he come from? And he says, that will never be revealed. And Philip Gerard, or Mike, however you want to look at him, is looking directly at Gordon Cole, David Lynch, at that time, and they exchange a meaningful glance. And I think there's something to that. Mm-hmm. I think they're trying to let you know, as the audience, that a lot of these mysteries that you're seeking the answer to, you're not going to get the answer to. So you can speculate and you can think about, but that was like, almost, to me, I read that every time I've seen it, I've read that as a tongue-in-cheek way of them letting you know, like
David Lynch letting you know.
Yes, of David Lynch letting us know that this mystery isn't going to be solvable, because if you look at the, because he looks directly at him and he's just, and there would be no reason. there's what, like four or five people in the room. There'd be no reason to single him out.
I like when he singles out Cooper when he says the gifted, and then when he says the damned, he looks directly at the viewer.
Yeah, which is very melodramatic.
Yeah. I also liked when he became Mike, the physical transformation that the actor Al Strobel does. It's almost like he goes, it's like his body fills up almost with air, at least it seems to. And it's almost like he has this weightless quality to him.
It's excellent. It's really well done because I'm a big fan of horror movies and possession films and stuff like that. And it's really cool because when he's Philip Gerard, he seems to be this agitated, anxiety-filled person who's almost like shaking with fear. And then once he undergoes the transformation, you're absolutely right. He's acting in this lightness, this weird movement kind of way. And that's exactly what would happen if somebody who wasn't completely in control of a body at all times got control of it. It would move differently.
Right.
It would have a different set of motion. So.
Right. And this is also where they mentioned haloperidol was that scene. Traces that are similar to haloperidol is what they said.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, that's a drug that's used to treat schizophrenia.
They said that in there.
Okay. All right. That's where I got it from then. Yeah. I wouldn't have picked that up on my own. So.
So anything else you want to say about this episode before we move on to feedback?
It was pretty cool how just the one thing where they start doing through the darkness of futures past, the magician, you know, searches for that whole thing. And they're saying it together. And then Cooper stops. And then Mike says, fire, walk with me. And I just thought it was not weird, but a little bit. Somebody else in the room should have been like, how are you guys saying this in tandem? I mean, is this some sort of poem that somebody wrote that you both have read or what?
Well, think of who's in the room. That you got Hawk and Harry, who were there for the deductive technique.
True.
With the stones.
Yeah.
And Gordon Cole. I mean,
I'm not
the whole
calling,
Blue Rose thing.
I'm not calling bullshit on the show or the writers for that. I just know that if I was in the room, I would have been, how the fuck do you know what he's saying? It was still a cool scene. I'm not taking anything away from it. And that's all I had to say about it.
All right, so we're going to get to feedback. So we've got our loyal listener, Daniel.
Hell yeah, it's always good to hear from Daniel.
Okay, so you haven't read this yet, right?
No, I have not.
Okay. Hey, Em and Steve, this may be my favorite episode not directed by Lynch. Mike's revelation about inhabiting spirits finally starts to provide a way to tie in all the spooky weirdness to the seedy physical reality of the town. Other scenes like Shelley and Bobby's welcome home party for Leo, Gordon Cole's debut, Josie and Ben's showdown, and Leland singing with Ben at the Great Northern are series favorites of mine as well. First, after all those episodes devoted to it, it is still ridiculous to me that Donna does not manage to get the diary away from Harold, and, with his suicide, this character and the mystery surrounding him seem completely wasted. There is a bit of possibly unintentional physical comedy in that scene, though, because when James bursts in, he grabs Maddie and runs out, leaving Donna to face Harold's rake alone. But then when it cuts to outside the house, James has run ahead of both girls to save himself. Well, to James's credit, I think he was pulling Donna with him.
So it did look like he was pulling Donna with him.
Yeah.
But
but it's weird that he grabs Maddie and but he does yell for Donna to follow him.
Yeah, we touched that on that a little bit. It's just kind of like, I guess you could only, you know, instead of tackling this guy who has the cultivator in his hand, the weapon, you know what I mean?
I know.
He just runs and grabs one of the girls and tells the other one, fend for yourself, hurry up, get out of here. But he is the first one down the alley.
He's a lover, not a fighter.
I guess so, yeah. A brooder.
I don't understand why Cooper. Okay, so he's moving on to another subject, and he says, I don't understand why Cooper takes a near overdose to Audrey to the bookhouse rather than a hospital. I think it's because what Cooper was doing was out of jurisdiction.
I agree. I think that's exactly why he kind of enumerates the reasons, and we just have to fill in the blanks when he's talking to Truman. You know, he's doing a covert ops type mission, and he can't really just show up at a hospital with a girl who's almost OD'd on heroin because he's going to have to answer a ton of questions.
And his next question or next point is, did cousin Jonathan rape Josie? Wouldn't his boss, Mr. Eckert, be furious?
It's debatable whether that was rape or not to me, because obviously sexual congress had taken place, but the way that she acted after it happened, it didn't look like she was forced or coerced.
She didn't look happy about the situation.
Right, she did not look happy about the situation, and I
But
know
Josie plays everybody.
that's true. That's true.
And the actress asked, Joan Chen had asked to be written off the show. So I'm thinking maybe there would have been possibly something revealed later, how she was manipulating him and in ways and maybe used, I don't know.
But it's a valid point, and it's a good question. And I remember thinking that the first time I saw it, and maybe even the second time. But after this time, I'm not so sure that that's exactly what happened. And let's just say that, you know, without getting into a long drawn out conversation about the nature of rape, let's say that there's a demarcation between a rape and sex that somebody's maybe not completely comfortable with, but they know that they have to do because of her entanglements with, you know, whoever else in Hong Kong and things like that, and she's just doing this to expedite things.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say for sure. So next he says, it was pretty sweet of Maddie to condescend to James' level at the lake, though it would have been hilarious if Donna had caught her just one more time when she puts her hand on his knee or kisses him on the cheek.
That would have been great if she
Yeah.
just kind of walks out of the bushes and she's like, James, you know, and then he has to explain this yet again, you know, why he's doing something like this. Why?
She claws her own face with a cultivator.
Yeah, really? Or she just picks up a pine cone, a really sharp pine cone, and just starts doing it, you know, whatever's at hand. But, you know, with all of the sort of quote unquote off the rails humor that takes place in season two, that scene, you know, as Daniel has described it, her coming out and seeing them doing that wouldn't have been really out of place. But I think they're trying to put a nail in the coffin in that relationship, so they needed to end it clean because that was her goodbye. So, but yes, it would have been funny.
So his next point is Leland must already be in deep with Ben's shady business dealings, or why else would he give him so many chances when he keeps screwing up? Makes me wonder if Leland got to enjoy any one-eyed jacks behind Sarah's back. In the original script, Leland instead sings, I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simpering and whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, bewildered am I. And he goes on with a little bit more of that song. It's Lost My Heart, But What of It, which would have been way too obvious. I really like that song because I have an Ella Fitzgerald recording of that song. And yeah, it would have been more on the nose of what we know about Leland, talking about the bewitchment,
It would have been less
a simpering,
humorous.
whimpering child again.
It would have been less humorous, but it would have changed the tone of the scene completely. So I think they could have made it work, but it would have been a little bit more on the nose. But I think this scene works just as well for what they were trying to do. But to answer Daniel's question about how far Leland is entangled, I mean, he's the Horns' lawyer, so
Yeah.
he's got to know a lot of nitty-gritty stuff, and he's also probably participated in some shady stuff to make sure that they stay on the right side of the jailhouse. And yeah, I would definitely say that he's spent some time at One-Eyed Jack's. That's just I had never really thought about that before, but if you think about what was going on with him and Laura, and whether or not Bob was in control at the time or not, I tend to have a soft spot for the real Leland. So I would like to think that the real actual Leland, maybe not so much, but with Bob in the driver's seat, yeah, definitely. Because it's just like Philip Gerard or Mike had said. He likes the pains and the pleasures.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine Leland at One-Eyed Jack's. Maybe more will be revealed in some, I don't know how they would reveal that, but maybe in 2016, who knows? Senate.
Well, if Ray Wise does come back, for the 2016,
I'm sure he will.
well, okay, let's say that he does for sure. There's going to have to be a good amount of flashbacks going on, I would think. At least with him, because he was an older looking gentleman when they first filmed it. So, I mean, he had white hair for the last four or five episodes he was in, so it wouldn't be much of a stretch.
I don't know how they're going to approach it. They might do this. I don't know if he would be Leland if he came back.
Do we see any Invitation for Love yet in this
Nope,
season?
it does not come back. It ended in season one.
So the fake soap opera is gone, and now the real soap opera's here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so on to his next point. He says, when Philip Gerard is being first interrogated at the end of the episode, Cooper asks him why he lied to them the first time they questioned him way back in episode 5 when they first showed him the sketch of Bob, and he says with clear fear in his voice, "It wasn't me. Don't you understand? It wasn't me." I take that to mean that Mike must have actually been in control that time, which makes me wonder why he deliberately lied to them. Also, Mike refers to Bob as his familiar, which implies Mike was originally in charge with Bob acting in a servant role, which would explain Bob's appetite, maybe, he's unleashed
Yeah.
in a way, I guess. I don't know how else to.
If he wasn't
I get a sense
familiar.
of him more like thinking about that, like him being in a servant role and now he's broken free and he's completely ravenous in some sort of way.
Yeah, he's got no controlling or limiting factor.
Right.
Because that would make sense. That would definitely make sense because now he can just roam around and do whatever the hell he wants to, whereas before, when he was a familiar, he was bound to certain rules and strictures.
He's reacting to that servant role he had and just like completely going the opposite direction.
Yeah, that makes sense. As to why he would lie, Philip Gerard would lie, I'm not really sure. But I do believe that when he's saying that wasn't me, that wasn't me, he was trying to say that, that was Mike. But he doesn't know how to kind of articulate that in a way that would make sense to people who aren't already kind of introduced to the world of the lodges and Twin Peaks in general.
Yeah, it's probably hard for them to understand being,
Normal people.
what are they called? There's the inhabitant spirit, and then there's the, what are
The
they?
host?
Yeah, I imagine being a host, you probably have some sort of sense of that inhabiting spirit, but it's probably hard to really put into words. So he knows it wasn't him, but
Yeah,
he really can't quite
how
say
do you say that?
who
Yeah,
it
it was my
was.
physical body, but it wasn't me controlling it. You sound crazy. Of course, he's taking drugs for schizophrenia, so he's already crazy.
And that's, he could be just, convinced that's what his condition is. So maybe that's why he says it wasn't
Or
me.
maybe he just has, there's some success that he finds using the drug that actually suppresses Mike, because they still have to physical, if you're going to follow the lore of it, a possession is a physical thing, so that there's rules that have to be followed. If a body dies, it's dead, so it has to react to certain things organically and chemistry wise.
Well, clearly it works because
Yeah.
we've seen it work, or we've seen it the opposite of it not working when he
Yeah,
couldn't get it when he couldn't get it
when it
in.
doesn't work. So that's a pretty interesting conversation in and of itself that we could have another time, and maybe about another show or about this one at another time. But like how you could actually use modern medicine to combat something along those lines.
And so more about Mike. He says Mike refuses to reveal where Bob comes from, which shows that while he is willing to help them stop Bob's host, he is still holding back information concerning the whole truth, which makes me suspicious of the spirit's true agenda. And indeed, in the film, we see Mike has known this whole time that Leland is host to Bob, and even still eats the same food that Bob does, which puts his claim of having been purified by God in doubt and makes his true motives one of the biggest mysteries for me. Something I really hope the new series addresses. Also, Mike says Bob has been near for nearly 40 years. Surely there must be more undiscovered victims if he has been with Leland that long.
Well, right here, Daniel's taking a more charitable view of why he says he's his familiar, but I can't give you any, I'm not going to divulge any more information about where he comes from or what he is, because I've already explained what I think is the reason for that with the significant look with David Lynch. But as far as an in-universe explanation to that, I think he wants to stop Bob from killing, but at the same time, I think he realizes that he's on one side of a fence and humanity is on another side of a fence. He's an inhabiting spirit. He's not a person. He's not part of the law that's trying to, you know, right wrongs and stop injustices. So I think his loyalties probably lie in a larger sphere, and that sphere contains Bob. So he feels like Bob is his responsibility, and he needs to get him back and rein him in and stop what he's doing. But he's not going to give too much information to human beings who can't really fathom what's going on. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, but I mean, he wants to stop Bob, but Daniel makes a good point that he's known since Fire Walk With Me, which takes place prior to this series, that Leland is the host to Bob. So why doesn't he just go straight to Leland and deal with Bob like he claims he wants to? Is it because Mike, when he's in charge, doesn't know how to function in the world that way? He doesn't know how to hunt down an individual, or doesn't understand that?
Well, we have one.
He can't describe a hotel as a hotel. He has to describe it how it is actually physically, and how many souls are in there. I mean, I don't know if he has a different way of seeing things, like the way a fly sees things compared to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, it's possible. I mean, he does chase down Leland when Leland and Laura are going to meet, you know, Sarah for brunch. And that's in the scene in Fire Walk With Me when he's like, you stole the corn and everything. And you smell the burnt engine oil and all that other stuff. So he does kind of go at him directly, but that's the only instance you see it. So it's a really good question. Why doesn't he do it more? And the only thing I can think of is, you have a valid point when you're saying that Mike is limited when he's inhabiting a host as far as what he can do and how he can process information, because he seems to be a pretty articulate and eloquent speaker on some levels, but then in other levels, he can't just simply say they're at the hotel. Mm-hmm. He has to put it in this riddle. And then the other point that I would add to that is, he knows that going after Leland directly is not a good idea, because Bob could just jet out in an instant, and then what does he have? So he has to find some other way to get him with his death bag, I guess.
He has to catch him with his prey.
Yeah.
Like he tried to do with Laura.
In the act. Yeah, he has to catch him in the act.
I guess that's what he tried to do. I'm still confused about what happened there. But we'll cover the movie eventually.
Yeah, when we get to Fire Walk With Me, this is going to be a 3-hour long podcast.
And thanks again, Daniel, for your email as always. And I hope we answered your questions thoroughly. I realize we didn't answer your question last week about why the Orchid's Curse was called the Orchid's Curse. And honestly, I don't know why. I looked up the Orchid's Curse, and I can't really pinpoint anything as to why that would be.
I think it's just a cool title. And Harold is an orchid cultivator. And he, I guess the curse of the, it has something to do with the fact that he's been betrayed. And I don't know how to put anything else more behind it that makes it sound more substantial than that, really. But that's what I get out of it. Like he's cursed to take care of orchids. I don't know. It's a good question. I think we probably didn't answer that one because we.
These orchids have to be in a specific prescribed environment that's really manufactured. There you go.
They have to be in a completely controlled environment at all times, just like Harold, because a lot of that episode was centered around what happened with Harold. Mm-hmm. So that was his curse, to be able to only be able to exist and function in a very environmentally controlled, in all senses of the word.
Which was unrealistic, impossible.
Yeah, so it's a curse. And he willingly let somebody into his life that was a negative element, and it contaminated him, like mm-hmm. he said in this episode. So that's why it's called the Orchid's Curse.
There we go.
I would guess.
All right, well, that's it for today. All right, if you want to write to us, go to our website at noship.net. Click on our contact page, and our email link is there. If you want to just write to us directly, it's at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. All right, that's it for now. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.